Hyperion to a satyr.
Welcome to the 26th episode of Hyperion to a Satyr, the Fire and Water Podcast Network's Hamlet podcast. I'm your host, Siskoid, your guide on a scene-by-scene deep dive look at Shakespeare's masterwork through the lens of not only the text, but many film, television, comics, and music adaptations. And today we cover Act 3, Scene 4, The Closet Scene. Now, Closet Scene is one of the play's most famous, discussed, and pivotal. Hamlet confronts his mother about her betrayal of his father, kills a spying Polonius, has another encounter with the ghost, and reveals Claudius's crime to Gertrude. It's a true turning point, as Hamlet must finally face consequences for one of his actions. Gertrude must now make a choice, and of course, the play loses its first character. In killing Polonius, Hamlet becomes Claudius, a father's killer, turning Ophelia into another version of Hamlet, one whose madness will overwhelm her. And for actors, directors, and even audiences, there are some important choices to make in this scene. What is the nature of the ghost? Hamlet sees him, but Gertrude doesn't, unlike Horatio and the soldiers who vouch for its existence. Was it real then and imaginary now? Can it simply choose who can see it? And if so, why not show itself to the queen and confirm Hamlet's story? We could also ask whether Gertrude knew about her husband's murder already, and whether she cares. On whose side is she? How does her attitude towards Claudius change after this scene? As the most underwritten character in the play, this ambiguity rests on the actress's performance and the choices made in this scene. Before getting into the examined adaptation's specific choices, let's look at Shakespeare's original text. It starts with Polonius telling the queen his plan and hiding behind the heiress. And in comes Hamlet, raving, but he has a purpose. Come, come, and sit you down. You shall not budge. You go not till I set you up a glass where you may see the inmost part of you. And Gertrude says, what wilt thou do? Thou wilt not murder me? Help, help, ho. While there are no stage directions, it's obvious here that Hamlet should be violent or threatening in his actions. That violence is not in the words, except poetically. But Gertrude is at least afraid of being killed by her own reflection. And if the production uses mirrors in the nunnery scene, then Hamlet's setting up a glass to Gertrude extends the metaphor here quite nicely too. In these lines, an actress might justify a certain measure of sublimated shame for what Gertrude has done. Posthumous infidelity, if not collusion and murder. But whatever has actually affrighted her, she shouts out for help, which makes Polonius shout for help, and Hamlet goes, how now, a rat, and stabs through the heiress. Important to note here that Hamlet thought this might be the king spying on him. He asks, is it the king? In other words, he would have gone through with it earlier in the confessional if the circumstances had been right, caught a spying rather than a praying. Or we could say that the passionate hate he shows towards his mother is what drives him to lash out and kill, but without that catalyst of rage, he couldn't have done it. Gertrude, oh, what a rash and bloody deed is this, Hamlet. A bloody deed almost as bad, good mother, as kill a king and marry with his brother. Gertrude, as kill a king? Choice here. Is the queen surprised that a king was killed? And if so, which king? Does she fear for the absent Claudius? Or that Hamlet knows about a murder she's already aware of? Note also Hamlet's accusation here. He says Gertrude did both the marrying and the killing. A case of man and wife is one flesh, perhaps, or an intrusion of madness, putting every crime on his mother's head. They lift the heiress and reveal Polonius. Hamlet gives him part of his eulogy and then goes after his mother, showing her pictures of her two husbands and asking why she would go from one to the other. Hamlet's idealized description of his father uses, as Horatio would, pagan gods. Hyperion's curls, an eye like Mars, a station like Mercury, even though Hamlet's idiom is more often fiercely Christian. Is there a reason for this? Has the fact that his father been denied heaven forced Hamlet to look outside his faith for proper comparisons? Of course, the comparison to Hyperion is a callback to his first speech. The mention of Mars, the god of war, is unsurprising given Hamlet Sr.'s military background, but is there not also the notion that the former king can be idealized because, like these gods from myth, he was remote, unknowable, untouchable. Again and again, the play suggests Hamlet wasn't close to his father and basically admired, if not worshipped, him from afar. Look you now what follows. Here is your husband, like a mildewed ear. The reference to an ear is not lost on this reader. After a few choice insults, Hamlet also says, "You cannot call it love, for at your age, the heyday in the blood is tame, it's humble, and waits upon the judgment. And what judgment would step from this to this?" Hamlet, like most children, would rather not think of his parents as sexual beings. His dismissal of his mother's passion and libido is a mistake, and explains in part why he can't understand or accept his mother's relationship to his uncle. The line is also at odds with reality, a legitimate take in which Gertrude doesn't love Claudius and would have married him for political reasons, as we addressed back in Act 1. If the marriage was under those terms, made through judgment rather than blood, why can't Hamlet see it? He has little objectivity on the matter. As we'll see in various stagings, the casting of Gertrude adds another layer here. Is she in fact an older woman or a younger one? Is she cast for sex appeal or not? Also, what devil wast that thus had cozened you at Hoodman Blind? We're back to a Christian idiom, but a hellish, not a heavenly one. The irony is that his father's ghost is now one such devil. Whether the ghost told the truth or not, and it seems it did, doesn't mean it's not trying to draw more souls into sin. Already, hell has claimed Polonius's soul. Eyes without feeling, feeling without sight, ears without hands or eyes. So more ears. And later, Gertrude, "Oh, speak to me no more, these words like daggers enter in mine ears." So a murder weapon in the ear. It's like a mantra used to invoke the murder and summon up the victim, who appears on the line, a king of shreds and patches. It's been common to show the ghost dressed in shreds and patches when it enters, as opposed to the war armor it wears in previous scenes, so as to heighten the irony and or complete that invocation. The present state of the former king is in fact closer to Hamlet's description of Claudius in this scene than to that of the idealized father figure. The images of putrefaction, for example, or likening him to a moor, a marshland that is closer to hell than the otherwise described heavenly mountain. But as usual, mirrors abound. In this part of the scene, the ghost tells Hamlet that he's forgotten his purpose. And since the queen can't see it, Hamlet has to prove he's not mad. He says, "My pulse, as yours, doth temperately keep the time." But this is not a trustworthy image, since time has been co-opted and distorted in the play. A clue that Hamlet's madness is very real indeed? At the end, Gertrude says, "Thou hast cleft my heart in twain." Is this an indication that Gertrude is in love with Claudius? While the image is that of a broken heart, it's one that is broken in two pieces, one for her son and one for her husband. Is one piece bigger than the other? Hamlet urges her to get rid of the one that holds Claudius, throw away the worser part of it, and live the purer with the other half. And as for not going to bed with his uncle, he says, "Refrain tonight, and that shall lend a kind of easiness to the next abstinence. The next more easy, for use almost can change the stamp of nature, and either rein the devil or throw him out." Hamlet's recipe for using habit to get rid of a certain behavior is actually enlightening. The suggestion is that if you assume a virtue, or by extension, a fault, custom and repetition will make it become true. This may be a way to understand Hamlet's madness. He starts out playing mad, which makes him mad. Only after taking a break from that madness, during his upcoming exile, does he become more reasonable and ready to commit to action. He reflects on his killing of Polonius. "I do repent, but heaven hath pleased it so to punish me with this and this with me, that I must be their scourge and minister." A villainous justification for wrongdoing, and possibly how Claudius justified his own actions. In a staging where Claudius is more sympathetic, we might imagine him wrestling the crown from a corrupt Hamlet senior, whose going to hell is not an injustice, constantly plunging Denmark in war, or a Claudius who kills for love of Hamlet senior's neglected queen. Such a Claudius might have explained his actions as a question of destiny, just as Hamlet does here. Finally, Gertrude says, "Be thou assured, if words are made of breath and breath of life, I have no life to breathe what thou hast said to me," which foreshadows her own death. On the matter of his being sent to England, accompanied by Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, he's his father's son. As Hamlet gets closer to his goal, by which we mean the ghosts, he starts to use military metaphors. marshal to knavery, hoist with his own petard, delve 1 yard below their minds and blow them at the moon. We'll see if it holds or if it's a temporary affect caused by the ghost's visitation. But Hamlet is soon to meet an entire army on his way to exile. Part 2 of Polonius's eulogy. Indeed, this counselor is now most still, most secret, and most grave, note the pun, who was in life a foolish, prating knave. We'll now see how different productions have handled this complex and difficult scene. Surprisingly, for a production that features a lot of mirrors, in the hall, but at least two in the Queen's Closet, Branagh's 1996 adaptation does not use them on the set-you-up-a-glass line, completing an image from the nunnery scene and linking Ophelia's potential whoredom with Gertrude's proven one. The scene doesn't suffer as a result, however, since the line itself does some of the work. The backdrop surrounding the room is of particular interest. There's a painting of people with the occasional dog sitting on steps and balconies, like a makeshift audience. This is Judgment Day for the Queen, and all of Denmark, metaphorically, looks on, trying to shame her. The scene begins with some energy as Polonius rushes in and Gertrude, ever impatient with him, pushes him behind a curtain. Hamlet's own entrance rides that momentum, motivated as he is by a mixture of elation from the success of the play and anger at not having been able to kill Claudius. He goes for the queen's throat, and she naturally cries murder, though one might imagine he was merely looking for some locket with the king's picture in it. Except that while other productions do use such a prop, this one has bigger bedside framed pictures instead. The accidental murder of Polonius is well choreographed, as he falls wrapped in the thick curtain, keeping his identity hidden from Hamlet for the time it takes the prince to inquire if it's the king. Polonius's highly redundant,
"I'm slain,"
is retained, making the character's last words completely unnecessary verbiage, the perfect epitaph for the character. Branagh makes it clear this changes Hamlet as a person, though it may take a few moments to truly sink in. He's now a murderer, the same sin he holds against Claudius. And worse, he's killed a father. His voice breaks when he gives Polonius his farewell, and he drops the dagger in disgust.
"Thou wretched, rash, intruding fool. Farewell. I took thee for thy better. Take thy fortune. I find to be too busy is some danger."
He gets back on track as soon as he sees his mother wringing her hands, however, as if she has no right to this shock when her own hands are stained with his own father's blood. He throws her on the bed where much of the scene takes place, but thankfully Branagh does not go down the Freudian route, at least not explicitly. He lets the words do the work of presenting a sexually immature Hamlet who, like a child in this part of the scene, is repulsed by the idea of his parents having sex. If the audience wants to read an Oedipal complex in the inappropriate way he talks about his mother's sexuality, they're free to do so. But the idea is not expressed in the staging. Violence and impertinence, yes, but the characters are not sexually inappropriate with one another. As the scene progresses, the life is sucked out of Gertrude by her son's revelations and/or accusations. Shame or tiredness? Her expressions are ambiguous. It's perhaps important here that Gertrude looks only at her former husband's picture and not Claudius's. But again, it's ambiguous whether the memories evoked are good or bad, and whether she's evaluating the brothers against Hamlet's praise and slander. The ghost reappears, this time as a veritable king of shreds and patches, kinder and sadder than his angry armored self.
"Do not forget, this visitation is but to wend thy almost blunted purpose. But look, amazement on thy mother sits. Oh, step between her and her fighting soul. Conceit in weakest bodies, strongest works. Speak to her, Hamlet."
The Queen's point of view omits him, leaving the audience to wonder if he's real and in control of who can see him, or if he's completely imaginary and, as the Queen fears, an artifact of Hamlet's madness. Hamlet is, in fact, desperate for his mother to also see the ghost, actively questioning his own sanity when she doesn't.
"Do you see nothing there?"
"Nothing at all. Yet all that is, I see."
"But did you nothing here?"
"No, nothing but ourselves."
"Look you there!"
The speech that follows about his sanity is, in that sense, as much for himself as it is for her. The ghost, potentially a devil in the earlier scene, has a very different attitude, obviously tempered by his love of Gertrude and his wish that no harm come to her. It's almost as if he regrets the fury with which he gave his earlier command, and wishes not only to sharpen his son's blunted purpose, but to make up for the consequences his dread command incurred. It's all gone off the rails, as they say, and it's ultimately his fault. If Hamlet was impetuous before, in front of his father, he's truly a child, and he cries like one. Now, once the ghost has left, he attempts to prove his sanity, a difficult feat given that he starts by pushing his mother onto a bench after she's seen him hallucinate. But this visitation and the blood now on his hands have changed him, even possibly awoken him from madness. He'll be far more in control of his words and actions from here on out. Moving away from the childish outrage of mere moments ago, he takes on a paternal attitude towards Gertrude, instructing her calmly on what to do about her situation. In becoming a murderer, he gets closer to Claudius, and so becomes a father himself. The fact that he's now a sinner, too, has leveled the playing field. He asks her to repent, but repents for his own actions as well, as an equal partner should. He's gone too far and knows it. And if his assumed madness became real, he now reins it in, turning it back into craft. As Hamlet takes responsibility for what he's done and for what he must do, he becomes a darker, more fatalistic Hamlet. The resigned way he takes care of Polonius's body, calling it guts, is, I think, proof of that. Previous speeches have been concerned with the state of the soul after death, but from here on out, the dead are decaying objects. The final image of the scene, with a reflective puddle of blood dominating the foreground as Gertrude paces anxiously and tries to make a decision about who to trust, is symbolic of her part in Hamlet Sr.'s murder, she was at least the inspiration for it, and of her son's madness which caused Polonius's death. She's torn between the two, and given how underwritten Gertrude is, it will take some time to clear up just which side she takes. Now let's look at the Olivier version. Although I think Eileen Hurley does a wonderful job with Gertrude in this scene, she's still playing a weaker version of the character than Julie Christie's. As the scene begins, Polonius is very stern with her, treating her like he does Ophelia, despite the difference in rank. This, more than anything, weakens her. Though how quiet she is with Hamlet at first, more sad and exasperated than angry, does too. It certainly makes the wicked tongue line an odd accusation. While we might question her power as queen, it does strengthen her connection to Ophelia, likewise a victim of all these men. Even Polonius exercises power over her, though to be fair, he's never been a representative of the king as much as he is here. Even the heiress behind which he hides has the picture of a king, and it's a king's death he suffers. Though this interpretation of Polonius seems rather benign, a more overtly ambitious Polonius is entirely possible, living and dying here vicariously through the king. As Hamlet comes in, he holds his sword threateningly, and quite close to his mother's throat too, but her question isn't as fearful as other performances have made it. She's calm enough to try and convince her son not to do something rash, which he does by stabbing the heiress, joyful and happy at the idea that he might just have killed the king, Olivier taking just enough of a beat to make the murder deliberate rather than an act of pure passion, though surely he must realize he just left Claudius downstairs in the chapel. The staging is rather good, with Gertrude in the foreground, we'll come back to this, and Hamlet letting the sword stick in the heiress, keeping its victim upright for the longest time. It makes sense thematically, though he's killed Polonius, the text has him only notice a few lines later, after he first discusses the queen's alleged sins. He literally puts a pin in it, and creates tension while we wait for the inevitable reveal that he has killed the wrong man. Now the queen gets afraid and angry, but Hamlet responds with a strange disconnectedness to his own words. His verbal attacks are made with the hint of a smile, and his cool accusations contrast strongly with his mother's tears.
Almost as bad, good mother, as kill a king and marry with his brother.
He's almost having fun and doesn't engage emotionally with her. Lack of empathy as madness? Where he is engaged emotionally is with his father. When he compares Gertrude's husbands, we see they both have lockets, Hamlet's containing Hamlet Sr.'s and Gertrude's Claudius's. As he describes his father, Gertrude looks at him, not the picture, seeing Sr.'s features in Junior. Here the adaptation starts to flirt with Oedipal themes and seem to justify a couple of kisses between them later, one chaste, the other a little more passionate. I'll have cause to discuss Freud's influence on the play later in the show when we get to a more overtly Freudian adaptation. Perhaps because of movie standards of the time, Olivier, while presenting a hint of incest in this scene, did cut or change lines that had a son discuss his mother's sexual activities. For example, her ensemined bed becomes the cleaner, lascivious bed. The filmmaker thus puts some distance between potential sexual perversion in the plot and perverse language, leaving the relationship in cleaner but just as ambiguous waters. As an angry Hamlet starts to choke the life out of his mother, the ghost intervenes. Drumbeats signal its presence, distract Hamlet, and make him swoon. We only see it in one shot. It's a slightly glowing shadow in the doorway, something Gertrude does not herself see. Otherwise, we're squarely in the ghost's point of view as Hamlet looks straight into the camera and points at us, the audience. This certainly reinforces the idea that the camera in the film is so often motivated by the ghost's gaze. In the early part of the scene, the camera is, in fact, more often close to Gertrude than it is to Hamlet. The ghost loves her. She's in the foreground. It's her plight more than Hamlet's tardiness that calls the ghost to action. After all, Hamlet's been goofing around for a long time now. Not seeing the ghost doesn't make it less creepy. Olivier makes his own performance do that work. Squirming on his side when the ghost leaves, for example. After it's left, we hear church bells chiming. Possible callback to the ghost's first departure at the cock's crow. Is it morning already? Has witching hour ended and sent the poor soul back to hell? Or was this all an artifact of Hamlet's madness, brought on by the cognitive dissonance surely inherent in almost murdering a loved one? From there, he grows kinder to his mother. Inappropriately so, perhaps. But what's really interesting about the end of the scene is the way Hamlet talks about having to leave for England. As so often happens in Shakespeare, there are so many words that some will often go by unnoticed until a slightly different emphasis in a performance somehow makes it shine. Here it's,
"This man shall send me packing."
Though the trip to England is concluded on, Polonius's murder makes the exile unavoidable now. And Hamlet, who does not trust his travel companions, may realize that he's actually being sent to his death. Thus his quick action to turn the trick back on his fellows. But turnabout is fair play, as Hamlet has also sent Polonius on a one-way trip to the undiscovered country from the To Be or Not To Be speech. This is where Shakespeare's traveler metaphor achieves its apogee, though a travel metaphor continues to be used in later scenes, like the one through the guts of a beggar. Death and travel combined. I'm now thinking of Horatio, who traveled to Elsinore and seems a ghost to most in the court. But surely this doesn't apply to the traveling Laertes, does it? Anyway. As we find Gertrude in the BBC version, she's taking her rings off, getting ready for bed. It's hard not to see this as symbolic, since it prefaces a scene where she is asked to divest herself of a husband. She's agitated and angry to start with, at Hamlet more than at Polonius getting above himself, which comes to a head when she slaps Hamlet for his impertinence. Though it's a good performance, Derek Jacobi overwhelms the scene as usual, so mercurial as Hamlet, that any given line may evoke some new analysis. For example, this is the first time Gertrude's idle tongue line resonates with so much irony for me, as his delivery of "go, go," a thoughtless reflection of her "come, come," is idling in every sense of the word.
"Come, come, you answer with an idle tongue."
"Go, go, you question with a wicked tongue."
"Why, how now, Hamlet?
What's the matter now?
Hast thou forgotten?"
"No, by the rood, not so. You are the queen, your husband's brother's wife."
She makes him idle, just as his line makes her wicked, and thus the slap. As she attempts to leave, he blocks her with a drawn sword, the same he then uses to repeatedly stab the heiress. Anguish is on his face, rather than anger, as he commits the blind murder. So Jacobi is truly making this about Hamlet killing the more ethical part of himself, and finally giving in to the revenge he's denied himself for so long. Contrast this with his counsel to the queen that she should throw away the worst part of her heart. He's done the opposite. Uniquely, Polonius takes some time to die after he's fallen, extending a hand towards his killer, much as Hamlet Sr. must have done towards Claudius, making the scene even more unbearable for Hamlet. After he's dead, Hamlet shouts his warning of danger at the corpse.
"Thou find'st to be too busy is some danger."
As if trying to reach him in the afterlife and bringing up the question of what happens to the soul after death, central to his early delay of action and his father's true fate. Indeed, does the ghost's appearance in this scene have any relationship to Polonius's sudden entry into hell? The emphasis on the line also makes us think of the ghost as a busy schemer whose machinations will bring on more danger. From there, Hamlet frequently alternates between quiet kindness and violent accusations. The pictures of the two husbands on each character's necklace isn't a new trick, but Gertrude's reaction to these is always of interest. She refuses to look at either man, especially Hamlet Sr., seeming to grieve anew for him. She tries to flee her son, pacing back and forth in the antechamber, until Hamlet throws her into the bedroom and onto the bed. Here it becomes a little disturbing, exploiting the Oedipal connections violently and sarcastically. The king's compulsive ardor is actually mimed, Hamlet humping his mother frenetically before he breaks down, his face in a pillow. Just when you think it's over, he starts on the ensemed bed section and tickles her cruelly, yipping like a lascivious loon on each beat.
Able to live in the rank sweat of an ensemed bed, stewed in corruption.
The behavior isn't Oedipal in the sense that Hamlet might seem truly in love with his mother, but is rather a parody of the Oedipal compulsion, showing the unnatural in the Claudius-Gertrude relationship through a grotesque lens. The ghost appears, still in armor, even if many productions choose to dress him in a more relaxed attire here. But this is not a relaxed ghost. He's very strict with his son, and only mellows slightly at Gertrude's plight. The visitation is fairly standard otherwise, but what comes after provides more examination of the lines through Jacobi's unusual line readings.
Ecstasy? My pulse, as yours, doth temperately keep time, and makes us healthful music. It is not madness that I have uttered. Bring me to the test, and I the matter will reword which madness would gamble from.
It's the word ecstasy that brings Hamlet back down to earth when he goes cold and mean to his mother. The tone Jacobi uses makes it clear that the prince is essentially saying, don't you dare say my madness and not your sin is the cause of all this. This Hamlet is far less forgiving than others, even after the ghost has interceded on her behalf. And yet, he's looking for a way out, and believes he's found it when she says her heart has been cleft in twain. He starts laughing with relief. He believes she can be saved, but can she? She hugs him, seems to believe all will be well, but when he warns her about sleeping with Claudius, she stops. In fear, in shame, remembering her love or lust for Claudius, with hesitation because she does love Claudius, his warnings turn to supplication and back again. There's still anger there and contempt. Jacobi turns, I'll blessing beg of you, into an attack at her ability to repent, as if to say, you can judge me only when you've admitted your own sin.
And when you are desirous to be blessed, I'll blessing beg of you.
He is so changeable that you can hardly trust him when he says he's essentially not in madness. Stern one minute, repentant the next, showing a flash of anger when his mother forgets he's off to England, and then giggling as he imagines his revenge on his school friends. Polonius's eulogy fits the same pattern. Hamlet is able to choke back a sob by the end, but is he crying for Polonius, for Ophelia, or for his own soul? And yet he still makes a Bondian death pun. Notably, he puts the murder weapon on Polonius's body, in a parody of a soldier's funeral, as if to represent machinations fallen on the inventor's heads. This is part of Hamlet's denial of action, justifying the accidental murder by blaming the victim. As the scene ends, we're treated to a staging that reveals Hamlet, Prince of Denmark, the play, as a black comedy. Hamlet dragging a dead body while cheerily wishing his mother good night. Okay, all right, let's talk Freud. While the world knows him best as a psychoanalyst, literature and literary criticism owes him a debt as well. The same is true of Jung, though this isn't relevant to this discussion. Freud's use of myth and literature to illuminate human behavior created a new filter through which to analyze not just that behavior, but literary works as well. His analysis of Hamlet, connecting it to the Oedipus myth, is justly famous, though it did inspire staging I deeply dislike. And among the best-known film versions is most obvious in Zeffirelli's 1990 adaptation. The idea is that Hamlet is an Oedipal character who literally, as opposed to metaphorically, feels the need to kill his father so he can marry his mother. According to Freud, and I'm simplifying here, men love their moms and compete with their fathers for their attentions. The Electra complex reverses the paradigm for women. Whether we agree with Freud's generalizations or not, We must agree it is a viable lens through which to look at Hamlet. Even if Shakespeare predates Freud by centuries, he was working within a theatrical tradition that included Sophocles' original Oedipus Rex. So the comparison is sound. Or did Shakespeare draw similar conclusions about human behavior and express them in this play in his own idiom? I won't deny there's something going on under the surface in the text. Hamlet's obsession with his mother's sexuality is an indicator of that. In a sense, his father's ghost possesses him, and he takes on the wronged husband's jealousy. He does not want to kill his father per se, though one could imagine a disturbing staging where a psychopathic Hamlet had killed Hamlet Sr. himself and was lying to various spies, and to us and to himself, throughout the play. But he wants to kill a false father figure. If he becomes his father's sword arm, does he also become his pelvis, so to speak? This scene is particularly important to Freudians because in it, Hamlet kills a father, Ophelia's, and then confronts his mother about her infidelity. Has she betrayed her first husband or her son? Zeffirelli goes the fashionable route by taking things a bit too far, in my opinion. When Hamlet is in his rage, he starts humping his mother in a kind of mock rape. That's certainly not unique to this adaptation, but he then has Gertrude stop Hamlet's mouth with a deep kiss. And it then seems like it would have gone further had the ghost not walked in on them. Where we might believe Hamlet's Oedipal complex from textual evidence, there's really nothing that should push Gertrude to an incestuous compulsion. She initiates it, and that's, I think, crossing the line. It out-ironies irony that a confrontation about technical incest, her marriage to her husband's brother, turns into actual incest. Going this far undermines the entire play because it infers a precedent to this inappropriate contact. We're suddenly wondering if Hamlet is jealous of Claudius because he used to share his mother's bed. And if so, why would he defend his father's memory so adamantly? In fact, why isn't the ghost angrier to catch his son making out with his mother? The staging just doesn't work. You can follow in Freud's footsteps, but you have to lay the idea in before this scene to make it work. And I do think otherwise it's a legitimate take on the material. Shakespeare didn't know psychoanalysis, obviously, but he would have known the Oedipus myth, which is the basis for Freud's reading. Legitimate or not, I don't personally like it. Certainly not taken to this extreme. Now, as for the rest of the scene, Zeffirelli's staging is often predicated by what dialogue he's cut from the play. For example, Polonius starts this scene without a plan to spy on Hamlet and Gertrude from behind an arras. He seems to notice the tapestry, and he's about to go out and decides to, slink behind it. This Polonius is definitely more benign than the text would have him, and certainly less of a schemer. His end is tragic, but less warranted this way. As written, he thinks himself crafty and plans his spycraft well in advance, so there's a sense of satisfaction when he's hoisted by his own petard. His death here feels much more accidental. And does Hamlet see him there well before he starts to shout for help? He slides behind the arras just as Hamlet arrives, and it looks like the prince notices the arras moving at the very least, or possibly even a dark shape behind it. It's a problem. Are we then to believe what he says to his mother is for the spy's benefit? Is that why he's so cocky? Why he mocks his mother's anger? Possibly. There is a moment when he forgets himself, when she slaps him and he lets out an inhuman bellow.
Nay then, I'll set those to you that can speak.
Which might make this idea work. From then on, as he pushes his mother back at sword's point, he may have completely forgotten about the spy lurking behind the arras. When he rediscovers the spy, he doesn't have time to process the impossibility of it being the king, whom he left in the chapel moments before, to which his victorious gesture testifies. The regret that follows may be motivated by not having killed the king, or for the consequences sure to follow for the death of Polonius. But as Gertrude starts to step away, he drops his sword and, through his body language, tries to make her feel safe. Where many Gertrudes vacillate between sadness and anger through these moments, Glenn Close's performance is heightened by abject fear. Her son is clearly mad and dangerous, and after that animalistic scream and on through their kiss, it's fear that motivates her. And it may not just be fear of her son, fear of being discovered, perhaps. Her question,
"I mean what act?"
seems to indicate a distinction between deeds and thoughts, a theme throughout the play. Look back at the things Hamlet accuses himself of in the nunnery scene. So, did she know about the king's murder? Was she in on it? Did she, at the very least, look the other way? The burial scene at the start of the film showed there was already a connection between her and Claudius. So, could she be feeling guilty that their brewing affair resulted in the murder? The necklaces with pendants picturing her two husbands are once again used violently as Hamlet almost chokes her with hers. It's Claudius's evil made manifest as jewelry, a way for Hamlet to emphasize the blight that he represents. After the ghost's appearance, or perhaps after the kiss, Hamlet grows kinder. There is no panic at seeing a spectral figure, but rather reverence. A calm falls upon him that contrasts with Gertrude's distress. He pleads with her to understand that he is not mad, never moving to coldness or anger as other more mercurial Hamlets have sometimes done. He gives her his necklace as a reminder of her former husband and to show they're now on the same side, or at least hopefully. It's interesting that this happens after she says her heart has been cleft in twain because she was already a creature of two halves, trapped between two husbands, or more likely between a son and a husband. That it is now cleft merely means that she's been asked to choose between her two loves. The purer half is the motherly one, which Zeffirelli unfortunately compromised with his Oedipal stylings. Hamlet's kindness extends to his taking Polonius's body out of doors, putting him upright before dragging him, less guts and more a person, with a certain dignity. He even leans into his ear when he talks to him through tears as things start to spiral out of control. Gertrude is left to look at the pendant her son has given her. What choice will she really make? It must be said that Hamlet 2000 cuts out many lines, for time as much as anachronism, but these do create dialogue juxtapositions that can, at times, illuminate the text. And as usual, part of the joy of watching the play translated into a contemporary setting is to see modern props, settings, and attitudes used to give well-known scenes a new spin. The setting in this case is an odd bedroom. The bed's backboard is nudged right to a wall of skyscraper windows. No curtains. This later causes a technical hiccup, actually, when the boom microphone becomes visible in its reflection, but that's neither here nor there. A kind of tower from which the royals can survey the realm, but also one where their incestuous debauchery would be visible to everyone. They're clearly shameless, and shame, or lack of it, is an important theme in this scene. As we come into it, it's set up like a bedroom farce. Polonius is sitting on the bed and rushes off to a mirrored closet, coming out again comically to grab his forgotten coat. There may not be something going on between Gertrude and Polonius. At least we hope not. And Bill Murray's effete performance keeps us away from any post-coital thoughts here. But he's acting as the king's proxy and at least creating the portrait of an affair, perhaps an echo of Gertrude's original adultery. Hamlet walks into her apartment and immediately moves to the bedroom, which is a bit suspect, but makes sense if he thinks to find Claudius there or plans to accuse his mother of adultery in full sight of the bed, which seems a bit calculated for this particular Hamlet, but it's still possible. He angers her and gets slapped hard, at which point he actually uses the closet door to set her up a glass, literally showing her her own sin. It's a tableau that recalls Branagh's nunnery scene. When Polonius starts shouting, it's not a dagger Hamlet pulls out, but a pistol, and he shoots through the mirror, breaking its reflection. Polonius walks out, having been shot through the eye, before collapsing. This is one instance where the modern trappings can create an image the original props would have had difficulty with. Here we have a spy ironically shot through the eye, and layering in more irony, that spy is a blind fool. Gertrude seems surprised at her son's subsequent accusation, so despite her rather callous manner prior to this, she appears not to have been in on her husband's murder. Scared for her life, she attempts to grab the telephone, at which point Hamlet uses the "ringing of your hands" line to take it away from her. He jumps on the bed, throwing up the covers, grabs her, and chokes her with the bedspread. He gives in to violence, but not to Oedipal lust, thankfully. In this adaptation, the queen isn't shown the presentment of two brothers. The momentum is kept through movement, not words. The ghost appears to Hamlet as Gertrude is ready to pass out. It's just sitting in the room. The dialogue cuts, juxtaposed, "he glares" with "do not look at me," putting the focus on Hamlet's own shame.
"Look how pale he glares. Do not look upon me."
He's lost control, killed a man, almost killed his mother, and the ghost's judgment is unbearable. In his own mind, that judgment has just associated him with Claudius. The prince thus acts as an example to his shameless mother. All are sinners, but having sinned, this is how one should feel. Thematically, it's what cleaves his mother's heart in twain. She's split between Claudius's hedonistic values and Hamlet's puritanical ones. There's also a lovely moment for the ghost, a reaction shot to Gertrude saying she sees nothing at all. He looks askant, saddened, and regretful that he cannot be seen by the love of his life. She cannot see him now, perhaps like she didn't really see him before. There's an existential angst as the ghost himself doubts his reality. And in a sense, he dies again, never to reappear in the play, having been ignored and forgotten by his widow. The end of the scene is cut with a silent sequence in which Hamlet drags Polonius's enshrouded body through corridors and near the building's laundry. He calls Gertrude on a payphone to have one more word. Structurally, the purpose this serves is to put the neighbor room that he mentions well away from her apartment, which is required by the way this Elsinore is represented. It might also have been used as a reveal that Claudius is sitting in on the phone call, but that doesn't happen. Gertrude does not betray Hamlet. His goodnight mother, after the phone has been hung up, becomes more symbolic than literal, as if he's closing a chapter on his life. He's soon off to England and does not speak to her again before he leaves, and hardly after in the play. But more importantly, his thoughts of taking revenge on her have been quelled. It's goodnight to that part of his plans. Fodor's experimental Hamlet really scrambles this scene up, changing the order of lines and events to get the most creepiness out of it, but also to cover the fact that Gertrude hates her romantic rival Polonia, and the latter would not scream for help if Gertrude were in danger. Polonia's death scene thus comes at the end rather than early on. One of the points of view in the scene is a security monitor watched by the ghost, who looks bored and distant, cold. This is an odd conceit, but as the scene develops, it's used to create an image of the land of the dead. When the ghost appears to Hamlet, there's a flicker that makes the normal image desaturate and distort, as if we're suddenly looking through the monitor. The effect only heralds the ghost's presence and isn't sustained throughout the visitation, though Hamlet's POV is blown out, iridescent even, whereas his mother's is normal. It's not just the sense of the supernatural that's conveyed here, but perhaps that he's having some kind of psychotic episode, a hallucination. And indeed, it's the ghost that nods pointedly in the mirrored closet's direction from where Polonia watches. Real or not, it's the proverbial voice telling Hamlet to kill. And it makes sense that this ghost would want Polonia dead, as she appears to have been a co-conspirator in his murder. Or he may just want to push Hamlet over the edge to turn him into the weapon he needs him to be. If the ghost is not real, then Hamlet is merely picking up on his mother's early reference to seeing black and granite spots as she looks right into the mirrored door, a secret cue to warn him that they're being watched, something his psychotic break makes him subconsciously realize. However, because we so often see the ghost in this film from an omniscient third-person perspective, we must accept that the ghost is real, but it may be that we are as mad as Hamlet. The way the lines are stacked and performed in this adaptation, Hamlet is less of an accuser and more of a convincer. That's because Gertrude is already well on her way to rejecting Claudius, who she knows is already being unfaithful to her, with Polonia. As her son begins to speak, flashbacks to such indiscretions crossfade through the screen. The same words, and if somehow shared images, bring a smile to closet queen Polonia's face. There's no real violence between mother and son, even once Hamlet pulls out a gun. And after Polonia's death, Gertrude easily promises not to let Claudius tempt her to bed, nodding emphatically, comforting him completely sincere. Once again, we must contend with the parts of her dialogue being delivered in German, which isn't so baffling in the context of royal pairings. Gertrude might well have been another country's alliance with Denmark, a rare pearl from another realm that two brothers fought over, though that's not very relevant to this modern staging. After the ghost leaves, a pounding beat is introduced in the score. Hamlet makes his mother sit in front of the mirror, introducing the line about setting up a glass much later in the scene, as he points a gun at her reflection. Her death will be a symbolic one, the death of the mother he hates, allowing her to be reborn on his side rather than her husband's. Polonia senses the bullets flying around her and, in an interesting bit of editing, flashes, as perhaps Hamlet does too, to the ice pick murder shown in Hamlet's film. As the ice pick enters the ear, so does a bullet penetrate her. The door opens, and to Hamlet's horror, he hasn't killed Claudius, but instead his mistress. Horror at having killed, at any rate, and in realizing he must kill again to honor his revenge pact. Polonia is framed in a smaller screen, her skin blue, with a treatment that makes it seem like she's part of Hamlet's film, oddly slowed down, choking sounds coming from her. This is where the fantasy of death and its reality converge, the cognitive dissonance Hamlet experiences. Polonia's death is almost painterly, a posed tableau, and eventually the screen, colors, and treatment adjust to normality, or what passes for it in this horrific version, and her death becomes real. Hamlet cries for his own soul, if not for the villain's. In 2009's David Tennant version, Penny Downey's Gertrude starts the closet scene by taking off her queen's raiments. This is to be an intimate scene, without benefit of makeup or hairpiece, played in simple gray silk pajamas. When Polonius comes in, she's smoking a cigarette, drinking scotch whiskey, and generally angry at both her son and this little man, who imposes his presence on the moment.
I'll silence me even here. Pray you be round with him.
I'll warrant you fear me not. Be sure I hear him coming.
Polonius hides behind a mirrored closet door, as in Hamlet 2000, which again will become an important symbol. While Gertrude downs her liquid courage, Hamlet can be heard coming from deep inside Elsinore, shouting and ranting, cawing mother as if a crow. When he enters, he's still wearing his player's crown, which he takes off his head impatiently. For all her outrage and bluster, she misses the point that this is exactly what she did to him by marrying his uncle, interrupted the normal succession. She took a crown from him, but Gertrude, though sharp-witted, has a particular blind spot when it comes to her family relationships and, for example, did not catch the suggestion that Claudius killed her first husband from the details of Hamlet's play. The trouble they have communicating, likely a recent development, is what makes them act so frustrated by one another. She almost slaps him, but it turns into a kinder tap on the chest. Emotional blackmail rather than punitive violence. But Hamlet, at this point, will have none of it and responds with violence. Tennant's acting strategy is to discover the text as he says it, which creates an impressive freshness to words more than 400 years old. For example, he plays with your husband's brother's wife as if comically working out its complexities.
You are the queen, your husband's brother's wife.
Later, he'll find epithets like fanged only after a pause, considering the word adders less than sufficient to describe the treacherous Rosencrantz and Guildenstern.
And my two schoolfellows, whom I will trust as I will adders, fanged.
And so it is with the violence and intensity of the scene. He throws Gertrude on the bed, pulls her face towards newspapers with photos of the two kings, jumps on the bed, and makes it all seem unchoreographed and dangerous. He also discovers Gertrude's text. When she asks if he would murder her, it makes him take pause. Disturbs him, shocked that he might have done it in a fit of rage. She starts to crawl towards her nightstand in fear for her life, and in the drawer is a gun. She doesn't draw it. That's when she starts to shout for help, making it very clear that she's asking for Polonius specifically, her eyes darting to the closet. Typically, the old man is slow on the uptake. Hamlet has time to grab the gun and shoot him, shattering the mirror, a device which was used on a large mirrored wall in the stage play. Polonius stumbles out and collapses behind more mirrors, and it's only when Hamlet illuminates his form with a match that he realizes it wasn't the king. As the match burns out, Polonius' life on stage is extinguished forever. The fractured mirror is an important element in the staging of this adaptation. Hamlet looks at himself in it, an image of his fractured mind. Even if we accept that he's not mad, he's still split between competing motivations, as is the queen by the end of this scene. The shattered mirror occurs when Polonius is killed, representing the fracturing of Danish society. Remember that Laertes will return to avenge his father, the voice of revolt, with rebels at his heels. And it's also playing on the idea that Claudius and the ghost are played by the same actor, the latter character walking out of the portal. That is to say, that shattered mirror. The presentment of two brothers, nearly identical, takes the bent of irony, but as we accept them as two different men, we'll note that Gertrude looks long and hard at her first husband in the newspaper, still apparently grieving. She knows what she's lost and that her second love doesn't invalidate her first. In fact, she turns to Hamlet and recognizes her father's bearing in him. The love she bears for her son is informed by Hamlet being all that's left of Hamlet Sr. We were warned about the witching hour, and it arrives with a gently chiming clock on the dresser. It's midnight, and the ghost makes its appearance, a gray figure, pointing at its son, angry. When it notices Gertrude, it grows kinder, and director Gregory Doran's contribution to the scene is to place them in the same shot, close together, an image of a family reunited. The ghost even touches her hair, which she slips back into place without noticing. It's an image that will make Hamlet accept he must work with his mother rather than against her, but it's also an ironic image. For all his allusions to Claudius being a kind of walking corpse, some revolting, rotting thing, here his mother is sitting on the bed with an actual dead man. This is the state Hamlet would have preferred for his mother, a widow sleeping with the ghost of her husband forevermore. Gertrude's subtle reaction to his saying her blood is tame, a kind of exasperation, says it all. Children seldom want to recognize their parents' sexuality, even though they obviously sprang from it. Because she can't see the apparition, her fears that Hamlet is truly mad are confirmed, and his attempts to reel her back into his plan very nearly fall on deaf ears. What she responds to is the childish part of him, which comes and goes. They're trying to reconnect. He pleads with her to not tell stepdad, and hugs her waist. She plays a game of secrets with him, fingers on lips, and shushes him while he cries. But it's not long before he must become an adult again, one that talks of killing. They don't need to find that old connection. They need to forge a new one. And it's what they do as uneasy co-conspirators. Gertrude's reactions in this last sequence are incredible. When Hamlet asks her to throw away the worst part of her cleft heart, she laughs in his face, with an expression that says, easier said than done, because it's not a woman's place to refuse her husband's advances, or because she can't deny someone she loves, or perhaps someone who could kill her. It's why he keeps giving her advice in that sense, showing her how she might stay on the wagon, as it were. Penny Downey's performance is incredibly naturalistic, and Gertrude's own mind is in danger of snapping under that emotional strain. Before Hamlet leaves, a final cruelty. Though he repents what he's done to Polonius, he can't help but pronounce a disdainful eulogy for the man. He gives his mother a quick and surprising kiss on the lips and knavishly intones his good nights.
Night, mother!
The absurdity of it all makes her break out laughing, a laugh that immediately turns into a tear-stained grimace. This adaptation continues to enchant and surprise me.
Speak no more. I drench mine eyes into my very soul, and there I see such black and grained spots as will not leave their teeth.
Nay, but to live in the rank sweat of an enseamed bed, stewed in corruption, honeying and making love over a nasty sty.
No, speak to me no more. My words like daggers entering my ears. No more.
Playing the scene on the floor, Slings and Arrows offers a simple, pared-down staging that really speaks to the scene's power. We don't get enough of it to discuss any particulars, but the fact that such a brief excerpt still manages to move this viewer speaks volumes. The scene is, of course, supported by a shot of the audience enraptured. That's one of the things the Canadian series does very well. Show the power of theater as theater. Due to my location, I've never had the pleasure of seeing Hamlet on stage in person, but I can only imagine. In person, I've seen some Shakespeare, sure, usually comedies, but they've been amateur or student productions, and even the least proficient ones have still satisfied me, because the text is so strong. Anyway, why haven't you watched Slings and Arrows yet? It's just 3 6-episode seasons. I'll guarantee you'll love it.
What will that do? That will not murder me! Help! How?
I'm now a rat!
The rush of a Midwinter's Dreams montage, doing the entire play in only a few on-screen minutes and providing moments of humor throughout, gives us another dynamically staged excerpt from Branagh's comedy. Hamlet pushes his mother across the stage until she backs to the draped doors where Polonius is hidden, and as if part of the same movement that would have seen his mother harmed, the prince kills the rat whose shadow is revealed there. Blood is splashed on the curtains in a horror movie kind of way, and as a means to intercut a shocked audience for comic effect. But the underlying point remains. The answer to "Thou wilt not murder me" might well have been yes, without Polonius' fortuitous interruption. And indeed, his entry into the afterlife could be what signaled the ghost that something was amiss. Without Polonius there, behind the arras, things might have turned out very differently. The old man did something right after all, in the end. Comics-wise, while the original Classics Illustrated cuts a lot of the play down to the bare essentials, it gives this scene 7 pages, including a 2-page splash. It shouldn't come as too much of a surprise, since these comics had a boy's own adventure style, and the scene features both a sword killing and the ghost. There are still a lot of cuts, mind you. The extra space is given over to action, not to words. As you can imagine, though this Gertrude looks young and sexy, the comic removes Hamlet's rage over his mother's sexuality. Classics Illustrated was hardly an innovative enterprise, but we do get a very comic book moment in the showing of the counterfeit presentment of the two brothers, with their pictures inset in the corner facing each other. Something else comics do differently than plays and films is using captions that interpret the action in a third-person omniscient voice. The adaptation does so to cover cuts or clarify actions that would not be clear to its likely preteen audience. Some of these interpretations are a little dubious. As Hamlet attacks his mother, we learn that he continues as though the queen had not spoken, suggesting the author believes her expressed regret was contrition enough. Captions are also quick to clarify that she can't see the ghost. The two-page splash, featuring the appearance of the ghost, is designed to entrance young readers. While lines are cut like so much fat, a lot of space is devoted to keeping this audience interested. Speaking of cuts, the scene soon wraps up with massive ones made to Hamlet's final conversation with his mother. After "Thou hast cleft my heart in twain," she doesn't speak again. Hamlet simply tells her to throw away the worst part and that he's off to England. Even the grave pun is omitted in the rush to drag Polonius' body out of the queen's closet and move on. Oh, and according to the footnotes, words kids are not expected to know. Glass, meaning mirror, and adders, here defined as very poisonous snakes. By contrast, the Stephen Grant Tom Mandrake adaptation keeps the scene down to 3 pages, but manages to keep more of the text intact. As usual, Mandrake's art expresses a dark and foreboding mood. Coming into the room, Hamlet already has his sword out and the queen is already running from it, which changes the tenor of her lines, and Hamlet's too. "Would it were not so, you are my mother," has a murderous edge with a sword in frame, as if the prince is ready to end that state of being, just as his father became a ghost. When there are cuts, they're unusual and striking. Polonius doesn't cry for help, nor does Hamlet look for a rat. Either he noticed someone behind the heiress beforehand, or he heard a shuffling there, but he just stabs the heiress out of the blue, as panel borders get drenched with blood. Mandrake raises the level of intensity of Hamlet's tirade, closing in with each successive panel on Hamlet's eye and his mother's tear, a skull appearing in the prince's pupil. It's a Mandrake trademark. There's no actual movement, no throwing on the bed, no counterfeit presentment, just the sense that Hamlet is dominating his mother, his image impossibly close to hers in that last panel, even as his voice goes down to a whisper. A threat has never been so well implied with so little. The ghost breaks the spell and creates another. Unusually, it stays in the picture after Hamlet says it steals away. Unusually, it stays in the picture after Hamlet says it steals away, and crucially, out of the portal is omitted. So it is present when the prince gives his mother instructions to stop sleeping with Claudius. As with the previous adaptation, this end sequence is heavily cut, though it retains such lines as, "I must be cruel only to be kind." Still, Gertrude stops speaking even earlier, at, "Yet all there is I see." In other words, she does not actually repent. Hamlet only takes it for granted that she does. In this version, it's the ghost that makes Hamlet realize he should endeavor to save his mother, and her own reactions have nothing to do with his volt face. And, well, that ends our look at Act 3, Scene 4, and indeed, at Act 3. Next month, we'll wrap up the season with a special guest, an alternative take on Hamlet, and your feedback. In the meantime, if you do have thoughts on this particular episode, please head over to fireandwaterpodcast.com and leave them there. And if you like this content, think about visiting our Patreon page at patreon.com/fwpodcasts. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll return, dear listener, for our Act 3 wrap-up.
The rest is silence.